ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Corbin Middlemass. Have you got Ashes fever? Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It's called ABC Cricket Podcast. I'm joined by former Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of Test cricket all summer long. The Australia-England rivalry has never been bigger, so make sure you're across every angle. This is the best analysis and insights on the game, and it's coming your way. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here. This week, I'm speaking with ABC presenters and journalists about their best stories and interviews from 2025. I'm joined by Alan Kohler, Stephanie March, Matt Bevan, and Sarah Ferguson. Today, though, it's Lee Sales, host of Australian Story, on the tales she can't forget. Lee, what another great year for Australian Story. I am always amazed that this program, it just keeps delivering year after year after year.
It is so incredible. And I've been thinking about it a lot because next year is the 30th anniversary of Australian Story.
Wow.
And I think that it's a show that was so ahead of its time when it came out stylistically because of the no narration, the reporterless thing, which now is pretty common in documentary world, but at the time was really unique. And it creates enormous challenges because, of course, journalists often use voiceover to paper over things that you don't have explained well on camera or to link bits of the story together. In Australian Story, you have to have all of that gathered in the field because you can't make up for it later.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the show has always, I think, been ahead of its time. But the thing that amazes me every week when I'm watching the kind of rough cut before the, you know, final version comes through and goes to air, you know, I sit back every week and just go, well, that was bloody fantastic. It's just amazing.
It totally is.
It's amazing.
It totally is. And there's so many episodes from, you know, years back that I still remember. Like they stick in my mind.
Yeah, I agree.
Because the storytelling is so, it's just so well done.
Yeah, and there's sometimes unexpected nature of, like the one that sticks in my mind was about Wayne Bennett, the Brisbane Broncos coach, and his relationship with his son who has Down syndrome, which wasn't really known at the time, and just those revelations you get about people, you know, famous people where you learn something you didn't know, but also I really love the stories that are about non-famous people and just the incredible people out there living extraordinary lives. It's just great.
All right, so what we're going to do though, Lee, is let's have a look at some of your most favourite, I suppose, episodes of the year. And I know they're pretty hard to choose.
It really is. I know, it was really, really hard.
Really difficult. But oh my gosh, the one titled The River.
The River was absolutely extraordinary. All of these you can go and find on iView. The River was a two-parter and it was about a rescue that took place in the Franklin River in Tasmania. A group of whitewater rafters from Lithuania had come to Australia and one of them, not even while they were rafting, when they were having a break, slipped on a rock and got his leg wedged in a kind of gap between two rocks. And then the story is about the rescue mission. Now, it was one of those stories where it got some coverage in the press at the time, but Robin Powell, one of our producers, felt like, look, we haven't really got the TikTok inside, you know, story of how this rescue unfolded. Yeah. Can I make some calls? And so she went away and made some calls. And what we discovered was, these days, because everybody basically has technology with them all the time, and because this was a group of blokes who loved, you know, their boy toys and loved their tech. And so the man who got trapped's name was Valdaz. The moment where Valdaz fell and got his leg wedged, the fall is actually captured from three different angles on GoPros various guys were wearing, right? And so pretty much every minute from the fall onwards, every minute of what occurs was documented by them just on their home consumer equipment. And so Robin got access to all of that, and then she did interviews with the Tasmanian search and rescue people and the medical people and others involved, and Valdas himself. It unfolds like a thriller.
Yes.
I just could not stop watching. I was glued, and at times was kind of reacting, you know, just sort of, I was climbing the walls. Yes. I was just audibly sort of reacting to stuff.
I got a text message saying, there's a job on the Franklin, who's available? We just knew there was a man trapped, might require a medical team.
In your own mind, you think, okay, yep, we should be done and dusted within a couple of hours. However, it didn't quite turn out that way.
How does someone's leg go into a crack and not come out? Like, surely there's a way, there's always a way. And there wasn't.
You could see the determination in Vaudos's eyes. Even though his body was deteriorating, in his mind, he was not giving up.
We could definitely see the significant deterioration. And we were getting closer to that decision point where we were going to have to get him out by any means.
And also just an insight into the rescue effort and what, you know, the people on the scene had to go through to try and save Valdas was incredible.
Oh, it's truly amazing. And as one of the doctors who was involved, a guy named Dr. Joe Kippax, who's actually nominated for Tasmanian of the Year this year, he's an emergency medicine doctor. And he said, you know, you're trained for a lot of things, but I'll tell you what you're not trained to do or attempt, an amputation underwater of a person trapped in a vertical position.
The only position I could get into was kind of in a slightly spread-eagled, awkward position. And I really had to block out on the noise of the water and the environment around me. It's normally a visual procedure. You can see what you're doing. In this case, I couldn't see it. So I chose to not wear gloves so that I could actually feel what was going on.
And when they were explaining the logistics of, right, well, clearly you have to anaesthetise that man if this is what you're going to do, how? How do you stop the head from going underwater once he's unconscious? For the anaesthetist, the challenge was off the charts. For the doctor doing the operating, the challenge was unprecedented and off the charts. And you know, obviously trying everything you possibly can before you get to that stage. Oh, my goodness, it was really something.
There was a moment before I started of a real sense of, I don't want to do this. I really, really don't want to do this. Not so much that it doesn't need to be done. It's more that it felt wrong. So I really had to talk myself through it to think that it really does need to be done to save this man's life.
Incredible, yeah. And after watching this, I just sort of felt this real need to go and give Valdas a really big hug.
Oh, my goodness. Everyone involved, but yeah, Valdas in particular. I mean, his resilience, the rescue workers say in the story that, you know, they could see in his face his kind of determination to not die. But, I mean, there were that many challenges because hypothermia was, you know, obviously taking a hold. He was very close to death. It was just amazing.
I was in the slightly unusual position that my other role is within the hospital system as a trauma specialist. So I found myself being in the position of Valdas' treating doctor in the hospital. I certainly had to have a discussion with him early in the piece and explain that I was actually the person who cut off his leg. I felt like I had to apologise. And he too was quite emotional. But it formed a bond, I guess. Quite a unique bond, really. And I remember him looking up at me and saying, I'm sorry. But yes, I felt there was a real moment of connection there where we both sort of looked at his leg and looked at each other and said, I'm sorry, this is the way it is.
One of the things in that story that stuck with me was it ends with him saying he'd like to return to Tasmania and finish that.
Oh, my gosh.
26 metais, vis dėlto sugrįžti į Tasmaniją ir pabaigtą upę. Zindaužėm.
Well, it's welcome, of course.
Totally, absolutely. I keep teasing Robin Powell, the producer, and saying, yeah, he's going to come back and you're going to go down there with like 58 GoPros strapped to your body to get every last second of it.
Exactly. All right. Well, that was a great story of survival, that's for sure. Now, I love this story too. So from Valdez to Valerie.
Yes. Valerie was that little sausage dog who went missing on Kangaroo Island. Her owners, Georgia and Josh, were on holidays in Kangaroo Island in November 2023, went missing. Everyone thought, right, well, that little dog will never be seen again because an eagle's going to get it or a snake's going to get it or something's going to get it.
This place is huge. Like, this is...
This is more than a needle in a haystack.
We spent 5 days, I think, having a look before they decided they had to go back home and leave the dog here.
So we went to where she was last seen. They said, you know, try and leave your scent. And then Josh decided he would put his undies there because that was what smelt the most. It would be his undies. And I was like, why? We were saying our goodbyes and knowing that we might not see her, but we needed to continue on with our lives.
February 2025, there's a sighting of it in a field about 10 kilometres from where it went missing. And so then there was a Kangala Wildlife Rescue on Kangaroo Island. They put up cameras and traps and various things to see, can we get Valerie back? And then in March, they got the first kind of major breakthrough, which was another sighting of the dog, which was on camera. And it actually made me laugh aloud when I saw this part of the story because it's night vision. So, you know, when you see a film where they've got like military night vision and the eyes are kind of green and everything's dark and shadowy, it's that, but it's a sausage dog.
Yes, this is a tiny little creature.
But unmistakable.
I love the name too, Valerie.
Valerie, because it's such a distinctive shape. Yes. You just know immediately that it is a sausage dog. Anyway, then because it's basically been living in the wild for more than a year, you can't just go pick it up and, you know, just it's back to being your pet dog. Yeah. So it's this slow, arduous process that they were just beautiful, these people, that they went through to get the dog back. And so, yeah, the cast of characters in that story, all the Kangaroo Island locals, the mayor is just so entertaining.
I'm lifelong island resident and mayor of Kangaroo Island. I got sick of phone calls. TV stations everywhere wanted to talk about Valerie and I'm going, well, I don't really know Valerie.
The wildlife rescue people, the farmers who had the first sighting, the owners, the Valerie.
Yes. Valerie, gosh, herself. They love that dog.
And Valerie's now in the opening titles of Australian Story. And the shot, every time I see it, the shot of Valerie makes me laugh because Valerie just looks like she's got attitude. And I mean, people tell me sausage dogs do actually. Apparently they're very single-minded little creatures.
Yes, they are. They're all a bit the same, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would never go up to one and pat one randomly.
Oh, no.
They're pretty, they can be very territorial and possessive, but God, they're so cute.
They've got, what would you call it?
They've just got tood.
They've got attitude. That's exactly it.
One of the great scenes in that story is when Valerie's reunited with Georgia, the owner, and it's like one of those, you know, those videos that go viral when soldiers are coming home from the Iraq War or something in the US and then they see their dogs and the dogs lose their mind. Yes. The dogs pause for a second and then they just go completely mad. Valerie does that. It's very, very heartwarming.
What is she going to look like? Like, is she going to remember me like, oh, I'm excited, but I'm a bit nervous.
As soon as Valerie went in, she's looked over at Georgia and there was just a slight hesitation. And then all of a sudden you could just see the recognition. She went, oh.
It was like a miracle. It literally was like a miracle.
Hello, you listen? You remember us?
I think so.
We are just so grateful just so grateful for everyone and how they treated us and how lovely they were.
And the thing is, Lee, the entire world was watching this, right?
Oh,
it really was such a sort of hit of a story everywhere.
Oh, people love those kind of stories, you know, globally. Yeah, Valerie is a global superstar. And she's just got that sense that I feel like if my phone rang now and they said Valerie's gone missing again, I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, exactly. Well, there was, though, Lee, a little bit of, I guess, scepticism about how Valerie actually survived all that time.
Yeah. I mean, that was a really interesting part of the story. In fact, I could have happily seen some more discussion about that. So the mayor was very sceptical that the dog could have survived in the wild for all of that time and was basically saying somebody had to have been feeding the dog.
I have absolutely no doubt that somebody unknown fed this dog for the duration while it was out there. That little dog could not have come out looking so good, so shiny, without somebody providing it with a bit of love, care and attention.
The farmers who cited her initially said, well, we can tell you, we were not leaving out dog food. We were not looking after the dog. Like, you know, the dog survived on its own. And then people that are experts in these kind of dogs say that they are kind of ratters and mouses and they can catch food and they burrow. They're dogs that can burrow. But obviously there is an enormous degree of luck for it to have kept itself alive that long and not have been taken by a snake or, you know, by an eagle, because they're small and one of those eagles could absolutely have picked it up for sure.
Totally.
So, yeah, bit of luck, but I guess if any kind of dog was going to survive out in the wild, you'd probably back a sausage dog.
Sure.
You wouldn't back a Groodle.
No. Oh, absolutely. No, we have a sausage dog that lives next door and we have the Labrador and I know which one's the boss.
God, no doubt. Absolutely,
well,
no doubt.
That's it. Well, Valerie is now, of course, living the best life ever.
Yeah, oh, totally. She's getting spoilt rotten.
Well, let's move on, though, because you did a really great interview, I loved this, with Yelena Dokic. Now, as Australians, we just love her, right?
Yeah.
Representing Australia, Yelena Dokic.
She's 15 years old and can't stop her.
At 15, Yelena Dokic was a star in the making.
This girl is going to be a formidable player. This is immense.
She's had a really interesting life and Australians have really, I think, come to embrace her in a big way.
Yeah.
Her story now is well known, which was, you know, she was a tennis prodigy, grew up in Europe, family moved to Australia when she was young. She was super talented at tennis, but her father was this brutal, harsh man who governed by fear and rode her extremely hard, physical violence, extensive emotional abuse. And then she got to be world number four and then she broke free from the family and played on for a bit, but she just had so much trauma in her past that kind of, you know, brought her tennis career to an end fairly rapidly. And then she was sort of lost for a bit and then she had an amazing kind of comeback by writing a memoir and just being open about all of what had actually occurred and the full extent of which, you know, it was kind of hiding in plain sight, but people didn't know the full extent.
She's incredibly honest.
Absolutely.
And during your interview, as you say, you know, that moment when she had to step out on the Rod Laver Arena and play for the Republic of Yugoslavia rather than Australia, she still feels that, doesn't she?
Yeah, and she said that she felt was the worst moment of her life.
Would you welcome from Yugoslavia, Yelena Dokic. And her opponent from the United States of America, Lindsay Davenport.
You write in your memoir, Unbreakable, that one of the worst moments of your life was when you came onto the court as a young woman when your father had removed you from Australia to play for Yugoslavia and you were booed when you walked out. It was devastating. How do you process that as an adult?
That was the worst moment of my life when he changed allegiances from Australia to play for Yugoslavia 24 hours before my first round of the Australian Open on Rod Laver Arena against the world number one, Lindsay Davenport. And to, as a 17-year-old, put me in that position and to get the booing of 15,000 people, And of course, him watching at home in a hotel while I'm going through this, I just wanted to disappear. And I felt like so much was taken away from me in that moment, from me being Australian to me absolutely loving my fans and loving Australia. So it was one of the most traumatic moments, I would say, ever. I would rather take 100 years of beating than having to ever go through that moment. And today I look at that as an experience of going, that was the worst of the worst, and look at where I am today.
And incredible also that she said to you that she eventually had to come to this conclusion that her father actually didn't love her. What a thing to have to kind of even say out loud.
I know. That was one of those moments in the interview. I almost felt like you could hear the room like stop breathing when she said that.
Mm.
And it was really a heartbreaking thing to hear.
No, I've come to terms actually to accept that he doesn't love me and that he never did. And I genuinely believe that. And some people might think it's maybe extreme, but I'm a firm believer that you can't do that to someone, especially a child, if you love them. And did I search for answers? Look, I tried to reconcile with my father 2 or 3 times. And this was a couple of years after I left home. And I thought, look, I'm older now. Maybe he's changed. We don't even have to kind of talk about tennis or have this kind of common ground of tennis. It can just be a parent and child, father and daughter relationship. What you always kind of hope for, right? I tried. It wasn't possible. It's hard when someone's not even a little bit sorry or has any remorse. And in fact, he said he would do it all again. So I tried. And also it was always, even when I tried to reconcile, it was other things. Like it was always financial based and so on. And that's what...
So you said he would do it all again?
Yeah.
He had no regrets?
Yeah.
Never sought your forgiveness?
No, never.
She still carries and will always carry a just gigantic amount of trauma. But she has been quite incredible in the way that she's tried to reframe that, which, you know, she goes into in this interview as well. She's rebuilt herself amazingly with this incredible tennis commentating career, and Australians have really embraced her and, yes. You know, she gets a huge amount of support from the public, and she does a lot of work trying to offer encouragement to women in particular who are in domestic violence situations. So she's tried to, you know, use her experiences to help other people.
Yeah, which is so, so good.
Mm.
All right, we better just end. We better talk about a great love story.
Yes.
Because why not at the end of 2025, which has been a tough year?
Yes.
So tell me about Laura Aspett and Cole Clawson, because, well, they fell in love.
They did. And this is one I mentioned before. I love a story about not famous yes. people doing something interesting, and this fit that bill for me. So they're both, you know, youngish people, I'd say from the look of them in their 30s, maybe early 40s. Mm. And both of them, they didn't know each other at all. Both of them lost their partners through sudden cardiac arrest. As you sometimes hear happens to young people, like a perfectly seemingly healthy, fit young person just keels over and their heart has stopped beating. And both of them, they were both just really struggling.
After Cherie died, I sat the boys down and I knew whatever I said to them at that moment would stay with them. So I just told them about my own experience losing my mum. That when I was a teenager, I probably didn't handle my mum's death. I got myself in a bit of trouble, all that sort of stuff. And so I just said, you know, we have to keep going. Mum wouldn't want us to stop. Let's make her proud. But I honestly thought, we're stuffed. How are we going to survive without her? You know, she was our rock.
The days after, I mean, it was a blur. I wasn't sleeping, and all the family was sitting around the dining table. Obviously, everyone was very emotional, and they said, you need to make a decision about the funeral. You need to think about what we're going to do. And I said, I can't think about that right now. And I just put the pregnancy test on the table, and I said, I'm pregnant. Yeah, a moment like that, it's supposed to be a happy moment. You're supposed to celebrate it. But
that pregnancy was, it was incredibly difficult because it was so emotional and you're thinking the whole time, what if something happens?
And they each joined like an online kind of grief support social networky thing where people, you know, like you see Facebook groups and things like that. And they got talking through this group and they just got on really well and they had this shared thing in common that they could kind of talk to each other about and not so much to other people. And then they met in person and then they fell in love.
It was a very emotionally heavy day and I got home and I was just overwhelmed by everything. I remember taking a photo of myself and posting it in a widow's group and explaining this is what happened.
I read that and I just thought, wow, what a courageous move to share her story and her grief, her vulnerability. But it also triggered an interest because what she was talking about sounded exactly like what had happened to Cherie. And so I reached out to her and it's a sliding doors moment, I'd call it.
And one of the things I love about it is I often feel with Australian story like it is both, it's representative of life in that life is often, you've got joy that coexists with sorrow, yes, or you're carrying grief, but you might still have a laugh at something. And all those things just are wrapped up and they coexist all the time. And so these two people, while they were still grieving, fell in love with each other. And then they went on to have a baby. And it's just, it's a lovely story because you feel like, wow, bad things happen in life and then people somehow endure and they adapt and they are able to get used to their new normal situation. And sometimes other good things come along and happen. And they just both seem like really, really nice people. Yeah. And I just absolutely loved both of them. And it was just really a heartwarming story.
Yeah, it sure is. And I mean, just this point that the human capacity to love isn't limited. I love that, like it's the, you know, you can grieve and love and love and grieve and all those things and you can do for so many people. Like it's not like it's a limited thing.
That's it. I guess it's like when you have children and you have your first child and you feel like, well, I don't really know how I've got any room left to love anyone else. And then another person comes along and you're like, oh, now I love them as much. Like, yeah. It's just, you know, Cole, I think, says in the story something like, I thought you'd have to be over somebody before you fell in love with somebody else. But turns out you can still be grieving somebody and still love the person you lost and love a new person.
My wedding rings on the widow finger, as they call it, the opposite side. And for me, wearing the wedding ring, I even get some judgment around that, actually. Yeah, people think it's a bit strange, but particularly now that I'm in a new relationship. But for me, it's not just a symbol of marriage. It is a symbol of marriage, and I feel as though Cherie will always be my wife. Stu will always be Laura's husband. But for me, it's a symbol of my love for Cherie, and that's always going to be there.
Love can coexist. I'll never stop loving Stuart, and Cole is completely fine with that because I understand that he will always love Cherie.
Well, very nice to end on that note, and I hope you have a lovely festive season, Lee.
Thank you, and same to you.
And a great 2026. What are your hopes for the year ahead? I know you are always so busy.
Yeah, that's so funny you raise that, because I think my main thing that I've vowed to myself for 2026 is to, I think I'm just too overscheduled, and it's made me feel, yes, in the back half of this year irritable and cross at myself because there's only one person to blame for that, and that's me. And so I've made a vow that I'm saying no to putting anything in my diary unless it needs to be there.
Good idea. Slow down.
What about you? What's your idea. Let me turn the tables on you, even though it's your podcast.
Oh gosh. Well, look, to be honest, I have a son. He's doing his HSC next year, so my entire focus will be on feeding him.
Yes, good plan.
That's my plan is for him to succeed.
Oh, good on you. Well, I'm sorry to turn the tables, but it's an occupational hazard when people invite me onto things. I can't help it. I attempt to seize control.
You are a brilliant interviewer, that's why. All right, Lee, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Lee Sales is the host of Australian Story. Find the episodes we've discussed on ABC iView.
Join me tomorrow on ABC News Daily. I'll be joined by Sarah Ferguson from the ABC's 7:30 program on some of her most insightful interviews of the past year. This episode was produced by Sydney Peed. Audio production by Cinema Nippard. Our supervising producer is David Cody. You can find past episodes of ABC News Daily, including my discussion with ABC stars, including Alan Kohler, on the ABC Listen app. I'm Sam Hawley. Thanks for listening.